and welcome to our Baz Luhrmann Film Weekly special with me, Jason Solomons. What better, more tinselly, more Christmassy way to end the film year than on a high note with the latest film from director Baz Luhrmann, the first postmodern epic, Australia. To mark the occasion, I invited Baz Luhrmann, director of Moulin Rouge, Romeo and Juliet, and, of course, Strictly Ballroom, to partake in my In the Director's Chair series of special interviews that you can watch by going to guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. But for you Film Weekly fans, we have the extended, uncut, unabridged audio version of that fabulous interview that ranges across Luhrmann's work as a director, his influences, his childhood, and his aesthetics. His latest film, Australia, is a huge risk. Starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman, it acts both as an advertisement for a confident and culturally bold Australia and as a big box office draw that the studios hope will defy the present recession and cheer people over a long winter. No pressure on Baz Luhrmann then. So let's take a glimpse into the world that is epic, sumptuous and very, very cheeky. It's Australia.
Trusting man.
She Osmond's a pretty good bloke.
Yes, well, he certainly knows how to choose his employees.
Employee?
No wonder the place is bankrupt.
Lady, I'm not an employee.
Really? So you're just driving me all the way out to Faraway Downs as a personal favour to my husband, are you?
No.
Him being such a good bloke and all?
I'm driving out there because he promised me a drive of 1,500 head of cattle.
What, to buy?
No, you goose, to drive. I'm a driver, right? I move the cattle from A to B. All right, I work on commission. No man hires me, no man fires me. Everything I own, I can fit in my saddlebag, which is the way I like it.
Yes, well, it's all very outback adventure, isn't it?
I'm not saying it's for everyone.
No, definitely not for everyone.
Most people like to own things, you know, land, luggage, other people. It makes them feel secure. But all that can be taken away. But in the end, the only thing you really own is your story. Just trying to live a good one.
Baz, welcome to In the Director's Chair. Thank you so
much. No one has described my new film quite as accurately as you did just then, Jason. Because
I'm very glad.
No, I am, because actually that is probably the big problem with it, or the hard thing to sell, is that yes, it is sweeping. Yes, it has an element that is earnest. Yes, it is, I think, sumptuous and I think beautiful, but it is cheeky.
Yeah.
And that is part of the, I think it's what people are responding to, because it's fun. It's fun.
But people are also a bit confused about it because it invokes clearly Gone with the Wind, which is sumptuous and beautiful, but it isn't cheeky.
Cheeky. I think yes and no. I mean, cheeky is specific to time and place. I mean, if you're a great connoisseur of cheeky, as I am, when she goes, oh, fiddly dee, whoa, 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 that's cheeky. You know, that would have been considered kind of quite broad, fun humour. The gag in the ball, you know, where she's got the black dress on, she's supposed to be mourning, but she's tapping her foot, the camera goes, I mean, that's a gag.
Yeah, and I suppose Douglas Sirk, which also, films also remind me of, on a slightly bigger scale.
But
the intimate scenes, the kiss scenes, they have that, and that, they were cheeky. I mean, subversive.
Cheeky. I mean, cheeky isn't probably another way of saying sort of ironic, but what it is about is it's actually allowing the audience into the humour. I mean, you can't pretend that the audience isn't participating in the humour in Gone with the Wind. You know, it's a gag. It's fun. It's not situation humour. It's not psychological humour, you know, where we're observing through a keyhole. So, yes, the film has cheekiness about it, and I'd like you to yell that from the highest hill because I think the biggest problem with the movie is people think, I know what that is. It's a chick flick. It's very earnest. It's going to be like Out of Africa. And there is a heart in the movie like that. But I do think, as with all of the works I've done, they attend to the idea of letting as many people in as possible. And a lot of that is through humour.
But a lot of it is also through playfulness and references. And I wanted to start by asking you about how we refer to your style. Because if anything, it's unique. But it's also a magpieing. It's also a pastiche. Mm. In the truest sense of the word, I think pastiche can be used pejoratively, and I don't mean that here. I think truly...
I know it's a compliment.
Yeah, it is. Mm. I mean, there's a patchwork pastiche going on. Where did you develop that sensibility?
Well, I mean, there's a context to talk about. I'll try and do it very succinctly, which you know I cannot do. But, I mean, really, all culture, all, like, song, everything comes from a DNA, you know, song, African rhythm meets Irish tune, that becomes jazz, a whorehouse music, becomes jazz, becomes blues, becomes rock and roll, Chuck Berry, some English kids in London go, or in Liverpool go, ooh, let's be Chuck Berry, mm-hmm. grow our hair long, the Beatles. It comes from somewhere. Now, the DNA can either be subjugated, hidden, or I have tended to expose it. And I tend to expose it out of, it came from function, first of all. I mean, in Strictly Ballroom, it's exposed in a very blatant, ironic, cheeky, fun yes. way. I am both sending up all those, you know, hey, you know, Judy and Mickey, we can save the barn if we can only put on a musical. You know, let's dance. I know those kind of musical forms. At the same time, by sending it up and being ironic, I hope that cerebral folk can check their cynicism at the door.
But you're
and be
you're,
moved.
But you're in love. You're affectionate. You're in love with yes. it. You're doffing your hat or your sequin yeah. garment.
Well, I'm just talking about that with Strictly Ballroom because, of course, that game has evolved through the films right throughout. More, if you like, sophisticated, sometimes more complex.
Yeah.
Now I think I've got to the point where, and this happens a lot in art. I mean, you know, in painted art, you know, someone starts out by homaging or being ironic, and they eventually become it. I tell you who's quite interesting at that was Woody Allen. Woody Allen sent up, I mean, obviously he loved Russian literature. He obviously loved Scandinavian drama mm. and Bergman. He did a lot of sending of that up before he started to try and do it seriously, which wasn't so successful. But eventually he became himself, and I think his best films are sort of Bergman meets Cheeky.
Yeah.
Cheeky so, Bergman.
Yeah.
So Woody Allen is, in fact, Cheeky Bergman.
Cheeky Bergman. So that puts you as the Cheeky. But your kind of influences are Cheeky anyway. I know that you grew up watching this kind of cinema in
Cheeky Town.
In Cheeky Town in particular.
Heron's Creek.
Heron's Creek.
Yeah, the capital of Cheeky. Heron's Creek was a very small country town, 11 houses, inland from Wauchope, up the New South Wales coast. It wasn't desert outback, more like timberland, actually. It was a big timber area. I grew up on the petrol station, and we had a farm. And we were the sort of, you know, owners of the commerce of the area, because with 11 houses, it doesn't take much to be, you know, the one. And I had, there were two things there, actually, Jason, two big influences. One, black and white television. We had black and white TV, and in those days, in the 70s, I think we talked about it before, I mean, honestly, we just got dumped rubbish like, you know, Casablanca or The Red Shoes or junk like Gone with the Wind, you yeah. know, in the 70s when, you know, the new wave was king, who would go and, what are we going to do with this rubbish? Tell it, well, we'll put it in black and white TV in regional centres. Something else happened, which was the man that sold the petrol to our station from the next biggest town. Sadly, he was a rather portly chap and he passed away. And my father, who was in the Vietnam War, knew how to thread film. So, you know, Mr. Lerman, can you come down and run the cinema? And, of course, cut to, you know, a cheeky version of Cinema Paradiso where I'm sitting there and, you know, there are tins on the ground. Yeah. My father's breaking open and, you know, on the tin is written Lawrence of Arabia. You know, this is from a place called Hollywood. And out comes, you know, the film and Dad will hold it up and you can see these little jewels of images of Peter O'Toole in flowing robes, you know, going on. The nephew cannot be crossed, you know. And in those days, actually, you'd look out the little bio box window and we had to stand. There was a red curtain and the red curtain would go up and we had to stand and the Queen on a horse was projected and we had to sing God Save the Queen.
Our Queen? Movie.
Yeah, your Queen. Our Queen still.
Yeah.
I'll get to the Republic in a minute.
Do you want to broach that with you?
Yeah, you're the one who wants me to say focus, Jason, and then you bring up republicanism. I mean, give me a break.
So when did you, I mean, look at those magic images, those classic images, slightly, as you say, I don't know if you knew at the time, they were slightly hackneyed while, as you said, the new wave was going on and you were watching.
They weren't to me. They were, see, that's the thing. Children and rappers, I mean, you know, hip-hop artists, do not judge the source from where they draw their inspiration. Children just go, I like it. It looks good, it tastes good, it feels good, I like it, I don't like it. You know, rappers sort of go like, that music, I don't know where this Stravinsky guy, they don't know who Stravinsky is, they go, I love that musical chord, I'm using that to make something else. And I don't know about Magpie, but certainly in the same way that a rapper I mean, I then went on, obviously, having a huge education in culture. I know where this stuff comes from. I know what it's labeled. But I've tried to make myself not care, mm-hmm. not judge.
When did you decide that that's what you wanted to do, become have the life of an artist?
Or, it's interesting. When I grew up in this small station, my father had this sort of obsession. He was a bit obsessive, to say the least, in mad energy. Can't imagine where I came from. But he was obsessed that we be educated. And we literally did ballroom dancing, painting, you know, reading, skin diving, you know, growing plants, commando training, football. You know, we were the Renaissance players of Cheeky Creek, you know. and because of that, I maintain that what I do now is exactly what I did then. I did not choose to become a director because I don't even think of myself as that. What I did then was I'd be in this isolated place and I have an imagination, I'd go, oh, what about, hey, and this is going to get that chair and, hey, little Johnny, you join me here and now, you know, and we were doing sort of a full-blown out production, you know, of Starsky and Hutch with me as Huggy Bear.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, or something on television I'd seen. And that act of imagining an idea, planning it, gathering people around, finding a way of telling the story, revealing it, making a show, has been my life since I have no memory of not doing that.
And you were always the energetic sprite in the middle, encouraging the best out of everyone else.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I was embarrassed by that, I think, when I went to drama school. That label, you know, people, I like people. I really am energized by people. This sort of enthusiast part of me was a bit uncool. So at the National Institute of Dramatic Art, I then did my version, I guess, of James Dean, which was, you know, not talking to anyone and getting into fights and having lots of scars and, you know, being mysterious and weird, just because I was embarrassed about being a geek from the country, probably.
Right.
You know.
So you became this hard outsider, leather jacketed.
When you hear stories about me at drama school, they're very over the top. I think, like, I might have been performing that a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know?
But mythology plays a huge part in your
work. Yeah, because mythology is important. Because mythology is, I mean, there are two ways of dealing with the world around you as a storyteller. The reality, real, or the not real, which is the ideal. But, you know, I think I'm probably more on the Byron end of the Richter scale than the Ken Loach. Mind you, it is not impossible that tomorrow I might say, let me do a Ken Loach style work. By the way, I did one. Years ago, I did Living on the Streets of King's Cross, which is our kind of Soho. Yeah. A reality 16mm documentary, which went onto television. So I have done that kind of work, but I have tended towards the pursuit of the ideal.
When you dance your steps, I understand how you feel because I make up my own steps too.
You make up your own steps?
Yeah, and now we both haven't got partners.
Look, what are you carrying on about? You've never had a partner. You've been dancing with a girl for 2 years, haven't you?
Yeah, but...
And they've come up to me, who's been dancing since I was 6 years old, and you say, you want to dance non-federation and convince the judges at the Pan Pacific Grand Prix with 3 weeks to train?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
It always seems to me that in your work there's a reaching for a star, be it strictly more that someone can come from nowhere, put on a sparkly outfit and become a star, which we now see, probably thanks to you, every single Saturday night on television here in
although
the UK.
When I was making it, every single person said, you know, ballroom dancing will never be popular again, I can tell you, son. You know, so you, there you go.
It took 16 years before it became, like, you know...
It is a bit of a curse when you're slightly ahead of the... When you sort of do things first, you get the joy of being the one that broke the ice and the sort of sadness that other people come along and clean up. Mm-hmm. But, you know...
But I suppose when you could have gone on a flight of historical fancy, you actually chose to update Shakespeare. You chose to make it a grittier kind of gang warfare situation. Yeah. So that's interesting. When faced with that challenge, how do I...
That's horses for courses. That is, I mean, for all of the me in it, which I don't really understand my own character. Having said that, I am trained. I mean, I've been with some of the greats, hanging out, watching them do their thing.
Such as?
Peter Brook. You know, Peter Weir helped me. You know, I got to sit in for some of the rehearsals as part of the deal of the Mahabharata. So can you imagine, as a young sprite, sitting up on a hill watching Peter Brook rehearse from 12 o'clock at night and timing it exactly so that the sun would come up on the last line. God is a great stage manager.
Yeah.
But, so yes, I've had those experiences. Jim Sharman, you may not know him, but Jim, a bit of a recluse, made a little movie called The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes.
And he was
I mean, certainly in Moulin Rouge, you can see it.
Yeah.
In the dance
and same for CM, like Brian, who was the designer. So you know, and then I went to the National Institute of Dramatic Art, all that stuff. But what's really crucial here is that something like Romeo and Juliet, I came to a point. Yes, I wanted to address the question. You know, being mad about Shakespeare, being inspired by Shakespeare, Shakespeare being a teller of stories, but a participant, a player on a stage, you know, having a notion. He was a magpie. He did not write Romeo and Juliet. He stole the plot. It was common. People would do 12 versions of the John Brown poem, go back to Pyramus and Thisbe. What do you know, Pyramus and Thisbe? It's a Greek play. Why does it exist? It's a cliche. Yes, it's a cliche. Why? Because guess what? Right now, as I speak to you, two young people are falling in love. The adult world's in conflict. Bad things are going to happen. That is a universal human truth, and we turn them into story shapes. So most linear story has a basis, a DNA. Now, Magpie, Shakespeare Magpie, takes a story, riffs language like a rapper, you know, high comedy, low comedy, drama, mm-hmm. action, language, all in one piece. How would he make a movie, was the question. How would he do that? So once I set myself that challenge, then it's all actually applied art. I mean, it's okay, historical research on Shakespeare, okay. Romeo and Juliet is set in a world where religion and politics must be mixed up with each other. Yeah. Where could that be? You know, at one stage I was looking at doing Romeo and Juliet set in Fellini's Italy, you know, with sports cars and kind of gangsters, you know. But then I realized that my mission was to get that story, get that Shakespeare, get it in the mouths of contemporary actors, and to do for a young audience what someone had done for me, which was pull the curtain back, and they wake up after an hour or so going, well, I got it.
Mercutio, thou art consortist with Romeo?
Consort? What, dost thou make us minstrels? And thou make minstrels of us, but they are nothing but discord. Here's my fiddlestick. Here's a
Court. Either withdraw to some private place, or reason coldly of your grievances, or else depart. Here all eyes gaze on us.
Men's eyes were made to look and left them gaze. I will not budge for no man's pleasure eye.
Peace be with you, sir. Here comes my man.
Mercutio!
Romeo!
I'm not really proud of many things. I'm really not. Most things I think like, well, it's kind of a good go at it. But I am extremely happy that both in the curriculum here in England, in the United States, I was lucky recently to receive the Crystal Quill Award from Tom Hanks for the fact that that production of Romeo and Juliet is in all the schools throughout America. Mm. They use it as a teaching tool. I'm really happy with that because what I wanted to do was, Shakespeare was not this doublet and hose kind of arcane. I mean, most interpretations of Romeo and Juliet anyway are Victorian theatres, doublet and hose. I mean, I just went and looked at his life, looked at the Elizabethan theatre. I worked with my collaborators, Craig Pierce and CM. We worked in Miami and we tried to interpolate both a world that this play could sit within, but also a way in which Shakespeare would have perhaps addressed the issue of making a movie.
Love is a many splendid thing. What? Love. Lift us up where we belong. All you need is love.
Please don't start that again.
All you need is love.
A girl has got to eat.
All you need is love.
She'll end up on the street.
All you need is love.
Love is just a game.
I was made for love. I remember being in Cannes in 2001 and Moulin Rouge opened in a riot of
hatred and loathing.
Well, it was everything. There was Bollywood in there, which was before everyone was doing Bollywood. There was Tosca, there was Elton John, there was Kylie as a fairy, there was everything. And probably in one scene, there was probably all of you in the one song where the stars
elephant
shoot and they go on the elephant.
Elephant love medley.
Yeah, that's probably, I feel that's all of you now. Having seen Australia as well, it's in there. It's all the reaching for the stars, that the fairies can come out, that the sun can
set. It's true, but all of this is based on mechanical, quite methodology. I mean, there's a method to the madness, if you like.
I've got to pull you back now into where we are with Australia.
Good luck.
Very quickly.
Good luck.
It seems to me we're talking about Shakespeare there. We're talking about Romeo and Juliet. We're talking about Moulin Rouge, and your films progress with great beauty and with great love, and as I said, with great humour as well. But they actually the last two anyway have contained tragic endings.
Or elements.
Elements. Yeah. I understand, I don't know if I'm right in this, correct me if I'm wrong, but the news was that you tussled with a studio over the ending of Australia.
That's not entirely true. I mean, the funny bit, I mean, I tussled with the ending, yes. And in fact, I wrote six, I shot two, and the ending that I ended up sort of found me. I mean, like, just to give you context, I mean, it is the way I work, and it's the way I've been trained to work. I mean, Nicole Kidman's character, Satine, had a baby, a child. Her character had it until about a week before we started shooting. So, you know, I do layer things, and I'm relentless in looking for what is the right answer. What happened was, I shot a tragic ending, and I shot actually there's a very happy way of ending it. And in fact, Sim even made the wedding dress. There's no wedding in the film, by the way. But what happened was, and I think this is true, and it's a struggle, you know, because it's embarrassing having, you know, bloggers say crazy stuff about studios. I'm on a Final Cut director. By the way, so the studio came to me and went, whatever you do, make sure it doesn't end like Titanic. We want to sell some tickets, you know.
Well, this was my question to you.
This studio made Titanic, you know. So what does happen, and I do listen to everyone, and I'm very interested in opinion, but I am a Final Cut director, and basically what happened, I screened the tragic ending and I screened the happy one, and truthfully, they test about the same. Young women prefer, by the way, the tragic ending. The ending that I resolved was not either one of those. Mm. As I was going back and forth to the States, I was now getting out of my chrysalis of filmmaking, and I was meeting real people. And I know I brush up against all sorts of humanity, and people are terrified. I mean, it is scary out there. Mm. It's real. The wisest that I've met can only really say it's going to get worse next year. That's all they know. No one knows what's going on. Now, a function of storytelling is to be useful. And the ending I found was an ending where, you know, I mean, in the end, that ending that you see, there's a death, and there's a twist, but you're left with the feeling, I hope, that war comes, things might be dark, but as long as you are with the people that you love, then, you know, as the little boy says, the rain will fall, the grass grows green, and life begins again. And there is a great and grand film that has the final line, which is, after all, tomorrow is another day. And that, I hope, is the most useful feeling this film can leave you with.
I think that's what movies do, and regardless of the ending, I think it's about whether it's worth making the journey, which Australia certainly is.
Well, thank you.
And from the kickoff, from the start, I think you had me at good day.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I hope that will be the headline if you do a critic. You have me at good day. Although people think you cheated, so why'd you bother see the rest of the film? But here's an important point. I mean, you talk about cheeky. That is cheeky. The beginning of the movie is a bit silly, and it's meant to be silly. So by the time you catch up with it, you find yourself having checked your cynicism at the door, having an emotional experience. Because we're too clever, we're too cool, we think we know it all and we don't. And we better let ourselves go a bit, I hope.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I loved it. I was swept along in the old-fashioned manner, and that was such a joy in the age of cynicism. So, Baz Luhrmann, thanks very much for joining us in the director's chair.
I'm very happy to be cheeky anytime. Thanks, sir.
A huge Film Weekly thanks to Baz Luhrmann there. And Australia is on UK-wide release from Boxing Day. That's Friday, the 26th of December. I think it is a beautiful film, a funny film, a cheeky film, as we said there, with loads of influences, so much going on, and it has to be taken very much tongue-in-cheek. If you want to see Baz in the director's chair, you can by visiting guardian.co.uk in the director's chair. Alongside Baz, you can see my interviews with other directors such as Alfonso Cuarón, Gurinder Chadha and Mark Forster, to name just a few. Next week, for our Christmassy edition, I'll be joined by two wise women and a wise man in the form of Guardian columnist Hannah Poole, Catherine Short, editor of Guardian.co.uk film website, and Zan Brooks, the Guardian film critic at large and Film Weekly regular. We'll be picking out the DVD releases we'd most like to find in our Christmas stocking. Do join me for that. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer here on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, goodbye.